Hello, I'm Dr. Roger Steiner, professor and chair of ophthalmology at the University of California, Irvine, and director of the Gavin Herbert Eye Institute. I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Barry Cooperman, who is director of the retina service here at the Gavin Herbert Eye Institute, to our Medscape discussion about ARVO. We both recently came back from the annual ARVO meeting held this year for the first time outside of Florida in Seattle, and we won't get into a discussion about the pros and cons of the location, except to say that it was blissfully sunny in Seattle, which was welcomed by everyone, I'm sure. Barry, obviously retina is a major part of ARVO, and since most clinicians don't have the opportunity to attend ARVO, I think it's a great opportunity for you to really bring people up to speed with the latest news on what's new in retina, and particularly let's start off with all of the various trials on the anti-VEGF therapies.
Well, there was several, Roger, it's a pleasure to be here, of course, and I agree the discussion on the pros and cons of Seattle will remain for another day, but it was a beautiful city and a beautiful situation there. The meeting went very well. There were three, in my mind, three really big clinical trials that had data presented for the first time, and there were some follow-on other trials. The biggest trial, though, probably was not for anti-VEGF therapy, but rather for the nutrient supplementation, the AREDS2 trial, which looked at the addition of lutein and zeaxanthin to the AREDS formulation, as well as reduced levels of zinc and removal of beta carotene. There had been some concerns in the original AREDS trial that the dose of zinc may be toxic and that beta carotene may not be necessary. And finally, that in the original AREDS study, it was seen as a dietary intake survey that people that ate a lot of fish, therefore had high levels of omega-3 in their diet, and people that had high intake of dark leafy green vegetables, which are high in lutein and zeaxanthin, appeared to have additional benefits. So the purpose of AREDS2 was to study those various permutations. As a result, there's a lot of arms, and it was a complicated study. But to sort of summarize it, the addition of omega-3 did not have any additional benefit, did not help at all. So there's no recommendation for omega-3 for the purposes of it, of inhibiting progression to advanced AMD. Certainly, there are other perceived benefits to omega-3 and fish and diet and all that. So I'm not sure what the actual official recommendation is at this point by the by the NEI and the NIH. These were that study specifically was sponsored by the NIH, specifically the NEI within that. But with regards to lutein and zeaxanthin, there it got a little more interesting. When you looked at people that had diets, had the supplementation of lutein and zeaxanthin, these are carotenoids that help inhibit, sort of their function as antioxidants in the retina. But if you look at lutein and zeaxanthin, that not only functions as antioxidants, but perhaps help with pigment in the retina that might be protective against the progression of age-related macular degeneration. There was a benefit seen if you looked at those that had lutein and zeaxanthin with no beta carotene compared to those that had beta carotene instead of lutein and zeaxanthin. There was a, depending on how you looked at it, anywhere from a 10 to 18% less progression to advanced age-related macular degeneration over the 5 years of the study. So that was significant, and I think that will certainly stay within the formulation. Beta carotene actually inhibits absorption of lutein and zeaxanthin. So if you looked at the overall groups, there was not a big difference between the overall study in terms of saying that lutein and zeaxanthin were unequivocally beneficial. But when you look at the specific subsets, then you can begin to understand better, especially since there's this inhibition of dietary absorption by beta carotene of the carotenoids. Additionally, the beta carotene for people that have had either prior smokers or significant exposure to cigarettes in the past, there's an increased risk of lung cancer. So the lutein and zeaxanthin formulation was certainly safer than ones with beta carotene. And I think we're going to see a switch away from the old AREDS formulation that contained beta carotene to new ones that are primarily lutein and zeaxanthin based. That already exists, but sometimes can be hard to find. So I think those will be probably promoted more given the data from AREDS too. So that was quite significant, probably the most significant news in my mind of the meeting from a large clinical trial standpoint.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm certainly not stopping taking my omega-3s. because of the other benefits. But that is interesting in that the antioxidant properties of omega-3 didn't seem to make a difference.
Right. Again, in the original ARID study, those people that had dietary intake, that is eating fish, did have appear to have a benefit. It wasn't the primary outcome. It was a dietary intake survey. So the question still remains whether somehow eating the fish is better than taking the omega-3 supplementation. That's always been a question. You know, do you take your sources from supplements versus just good diet? So there's a lot of reasons to continue eating fish. Though there are concerns, of course, with fish. There's other mercury and other sort of health concerns with fish. So it's a matter of juggling all these things.
Yeah, and there is some controversy about the actual bioactivity of some of the omega-3s, and that you can be taking big fat capsules and actually not getting much benefit depending upon how it's prepared, in addition to the potential toxicity. So,
right.
So where are we with injections for wet AMD?
So, of course, the big trial, the first of the big trials, I should say, was the American one, the CAT trial, which compared Avastin to Lucentis. That looked at both not only Avastin versus Lucentis, but the regular injections every 4 weeks versus injections on an as-needed PRN basis. That was then followed on by a British study, Ivan, and Ivan had shown already their first-year data last year. Now they showed their second-year data, which corroborated the initial initial CAT findings, which was that Avastin was, as they say the term in the study, non-inferior to Lucentis. That's not quite the same as saying it's identical or as good as, but it essentially statistically means that, though there are a lot of parameters which favored Lucentis over Avastin in the original CAT trial and similarly in the Ivan trial, particularly with regards to safety. And so the safety concerns associated with Avastin continued to be there and were corroborated with Ivan. And yet the efficacy seems to be typically a little bit less good than Lucentis, but not statistically significant, hence it's non-inferior. Ivan, the second year, had some other additional findings showing, for example, continued reduction of serum VEGF levels associated with intravitreal injections. That's sort of a new thing that we're wrapping our heads around, that these injections of minute doses of anti-VEGF therapy into the eye can actually lower your blood levels of VEGF. And VEGF is something good for the body as a whole, even though it promotes the wet macular degeneration. And so there are some potential concerns from a safety standpoint of that, though we don't really see so many necessarily manifestations of what are classic anti-VEGF-related side effects. But there is a concern that the studies are underpowered to show those sorts of safety differences, and they might be there without us fully appreciating them. Ivan in the first year showed that when you give people Lucentis, they don't really drop their serum VEGF levels very much, something like 10% over the course of a year. And this was also true over 2 years, a little bit more than that. Whereas Avastin, the serum VEGF levels dropped by over 60% at a year, and again, progressively more after 2 years. So there continues to be a question mark there, but it's not fully understood. Separately, the MANTA and the GFAL studies had their data presented for the first time. Again, they were different studies in France and other parts of Europe that looked at the same comparison of Avastin to Lucentis, and they generally corroborate the data that Avastin is non-inferior to Lucentis. So we continue to have ongoing efficacy data that suggests that they are comparable. Again, typically, the results seem to be less good in Avastin Lucentis, though not always. And typically there's some anatomic parameters like OCT, which favor Lucentis. It dries the retina better. But in terms of what we ultimately care about the most is not a dry OCT, but rather good vision. There seems to be very little difference, and it tends not to be statistically significantly different. So that these results have all corroborated and buoyed people's utilization patterns, whatever they happen to be. If you're an Avastin user, you tend to keep using Avastin based on this data. If you're a Lucentis user, there's stuff to see that would make you favor Lucentis or justify what you're doing. So again, now we have CAT, Ivan, MANTA, and GFAL, and they all sort of corroborate the same general finding that Avastin and Lucentis are comparable from an efficacy standpoint and leave open questions as to whether there are safety differences.
What about, you know, the more recent, newer anti-VEGF drugs, Eylea, for example? Any major trials involving them yet?
So with regards to comparison trials looking at Eylea, there is no new data. Eylea was tested in the VIEW 1 and VIEW 2 trials that led to its approval, showing that it was equivalent to Lucentis and perhaps could be used on a less frequent basis. It's typically considered to be an every 8-week drug compared to Lucentis every 4 weeks. In the clinical trials, those two groups were equivalent, though in clinical reality, they're probably less different than that. But Eylea is now going to be studied in comparison to Lucentis and Avastin in diabetics and with diabetic macular edema. There's a large network that's been set up some years ago that's been quite successful, supported by the National Eye Institute, called the DRCRNet, Diabetic Retinopathy Clinical Research Network. And there's this trial that's just underway now, beginning to recruit patients. So we won't have data for some time, but there will eventually be some significant data comparing the use of these three different anti-VEGF agents for their other biggest use, or the other biggest problem that we take care of in retina, diabetic macular edema. The two biggest diseases that we take care of are, of course, age-related macular degeneration and diabetic macular edema, with a third place would be the retinal vein occlusions, which already have shown successful utilization of anti-VEGF therapy.
Now, as you know, one of the burning issues in this whole area is the frequency of the injections and desire to get more prolonged effect and take that burden away. Did you come across any interesting presentations at ARVO that look like game changers as far as getting more longer duration effect out of these therapies?
Well, not exactly longer duration effect yet, though we are interested in drug delivery strategies, and they're still being developed. Unfortunately, when you put an approved drug into a drug delivery pellet or vehicle and put it in the eye, it's considered a new drug. So you have to start over from phase one and start all over again. So that's still in infancy. There is a new drug by itself that ironically doesn't decrease the frequency or decrease the number of injections. In fact, it doubles the number of injections, which of course seems backwards, but it gives you better results. And that's Fovista, which inhibits PEDF, and that's given in combination with Lucentis. And that there was a large phase two trial with 449 patients, so much larger than the typical phase two trial. That data was presented last year. It was re-presented at ARVO because of the large audience there by David Boyer. And that shows a significant advantage to using those two drugs in combination. So we're having the first signs of combination therapy being effective for the treatment of wet AMD. And so that's going to be exciting going forward. They're going to start gearing up for phase three trials. That combination, it turns out that if you use higher doses or more frequent injections or anything else of monotherapy of anti-VEGF, just more anti-VEGF doesn't seem to help. So you have to go into combination. Fovista strips the parasites from the immature blood vessels and from angiogenesis and allows the VEGF to be more effective. Ironically, the anti-VEGF therapy tends to mature those vessels as you're treating them, so they become harder to treat. The Fovista strips the parasites off the new blood vessels, making them more susceptible to the treatment with anti-VEGF, and so that combination was shown in the Fovista study to be significantly more beneficial. So we're going backwards initially in terms of frequency or number of injections, but what we're really looking for is increased efficacy, and this really sets the bar higher if it's borne out in the phase two, in the phase three trial, rather.
Well, that's very, very interesting. It'd be very fascinating to see if we go in the direction of multi-drug therapy in combination, because that does certainly have some logic to it. One other area of retina that is always a source of fascination but intense commercial interest is advancing the imaging technology. Was there anything presented ARVO taking imaging to a new level?
Now, there's a lot of imaging work, and I continue to be fascinated by it as well. There was a couple of interesting things that I saw both in the poster and in the talk sessions. One of the great things about ARVO, of course, are the poster sessions where you get to see presentation after presentation at your own pace and have a chance to talk to the presenters one-on-one. So there was two different directions. One, Ursula Schmidt-Erfurth in Vienna, who Vienna is one of the centers, the epicenters of development of new imaging technology, did a study that wasn't quite an advanced imaging technology, but using imaging and symptoms associated with that. For example, vitreomacular traction is something that we have been concerned about. The vitreous gel on OCT, you can see that it's adhering to the retinal surface, maybe creating slight traction or maybe just adhering there. And the question is whether that somehow that promotes progression of disease. We certainly feel that that's the case. Certainly, we know that that's associated with macular hole formation and true vitreomacular traction. And there's, interestingly, a new drug that was just approved and being launched worldwide called ocriplasmin. The commercial name is Jetria, which is an enzyme, ocriplasmin, that dissolves vitreomacular adhesion in certain cases. But separate from that, that just sort of sets the backdrop. Ursula took a look and at the role of the vitreous in promoting progression of wet AMD and looking at frequency of injections. And she saw that in eyes that had a vitreous detachment, that there was need for less frequent injections compared to those that still had vitreous adherence. This is for wet AMD and vitreous interaction. So there's some evidence that suggests historically that diabetic retinopathy may be promoted by the presence of vitreous in contact with the retina, that is an absence of PVD, and that inducing a PVD may be good to inhibit diabetic retinopathy. There's been some suggestions that may be true with macular degeneration, and Ursula, I think, did a very good job, Professor Schmidt-Erfurth, in showing that in her study. So I thought that combined both imaging and anti-VEGF, showing that by using imaging, and potentially we have now drugs that can alter the vitreoretinal interface, we may be able to alter the course of macular degeneration. Separately from that, there's some really exciting other technologies. There are two in particular, I think one from MIT and one from Caltech, two of the very impressive technological institutions in America. There's one that has, they can now do whole eye OCT, where you can scan the cornea, the entire eye, and the retina, all with one scan. It's quite a remarkable reconstruction. It was sort of mind-boggling, the detail and the depth. I mean, our fields get even more closely linked, Roger, where you can get imaging of the entire eye. And of course, it has ramifications on how that's done in remote, telemedicine, all these things. So that's coming out of MIT. It's very interesting technology. I was fascinated by that. Separately, at Caltech, they're working on OCT that is miniaturized so that you can put it in a probe inside the eye. We're sort of, one of the directions that OCT imaging is developing is intraoperative, so that there are OCT scanners that are being built that are not yet commercialized, but are somewhat available, where you can mount to your operating microscope and get OCT images while you're operating, though you sort of have it in a heads-up display, and you can do a scan of the retina and then look at the result and then continue operating and decide if you've removed the entire epiretinal membrane or whatever. But now there's this is a probe that is so small that it's reduced to less than 20 gauge, and you can put in it, you can put it directly in the eye as you're operating. It can be coupled to the light source, so you can have continuous OCT monitoring. It has a smaller zone of about 2 millimeters, but it still allows you real time as you're operating. I mean, I'm not even sure how I understand how the display is going to work, but it just shows that there's a huge amount of interest of getting this fascinating imaging technology that's revolutionized the care of retina patients with retina, now being transferred into the operating room setting in a very clever fashion, both from an external standpoint, but now amazingly miniaturized to the level of being, in the sort of 22 gauge, 23 gauge size probe that can be placed in the eye to allow you to visualize from an OCT standpoint, features of the vitreous interacting with the retina, details of the retinal surface in terms of epiretinal membrane, deeper things within the retina. It's all quite fascinating.
Well, that certainly would be, and I can guarantee there'd be plenty of anterior segment interest in that as well for all of the areas that we cannot see effectively and that affect our anterior segment pathology. Switching gears very quickly, one of the things about ARVO is that there's just so much information from very basic science all the way through clinical studies in virtually every discipline. So we can't cover nearly more than a very small, less than 1% of what was there. But from an anterior segment point of view, my personal interests and the things I found the most fascinating were this ongoing intense interest and work in collagen cross-linking, trying to understand what was really going on at a molecular level with that, for one thing, so that we can possibly drive advanced healing as well as stabilization of tissue. There are thoughts of directing the cross-linking segmentally to different areas of the cornea to actually actively reshape it rather than just stabilize it. And then a lot of interest in trying to find different ways of getting the riboflavin and potentially other absorbing dyes into the cornea through intact epithelium. So lots of interest in that. The other one that I paid particular attention to is the very active development of the layered transplants of corneal tissue and down to the level of bringing in just decimase membrane and endothelium for corneal edema. And that is an ongoing controversy. It does appear, as we would expect anatomically, that if you can have a nice smooth interface rather than dissected stroma, that acuity on the average goes up about a line on the average, several studies showing that. But paradoxically and somewhat surprisingly, pure decimase membrane doesn't like to adhere to the back of the cornea very well, and there can be detachments for as long as a week out. So kind of bringing our two fields together, Barry, there's Mark Terry reported that he's now routinely using a 20% SF6 mixture in the anterior chamber for up to a week. And interestingly, not seeing much evidence of endothelial toxicity, even with the prolonged gas in contact with the back of the cornea, whether that's the fact that it's got 100% vapor content inherently, or whether it's the movement of the aqueous and the, around is with the bubble motion, with body motion, is hard to say. But interesting coincidence of those two technologies. And then the ultimate version is work in several areas, but Dr. Kinoshita, particularly in Japan, doing some very, very interesting work on trying to finally break down the barrier to endothelial cells healing themselves and trying to unlock that cell mechanism that is prevents endothelium from dividing. And there are other species like rabbits, for example, where endothelium has for many, many years has been known to be able to multiply and divide. And we'll see if we can get human endothelium to do that, or at least derive your own cells in a stem cell fashion and recreate new endothelium. So, ARVO is a perfect venue for hearing about those kind of more advanced applications and seeing where therapies are headed. Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Cooperman for giving us his time. This has been a fascinating discussion and a huge value to those of us who don't have the ability to delve into all the details of the retinal world. I'm Dr. Roger Steinert. On behalf of Medscape, I'd like to thank you all for listening in on our summary of some of the interesting highlights of ARVO 2013. Thank you.